From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Since our policy to overthrow the Syrian government of Assad has brought us really into a potential direct head-to-head military conflict with Russia, I have some important questions along this line.
That was Representative Tulsi Gabbard, Democratic member of the House of Representatives Armed Services Committee, questioning Defense Secretary Ashton Carter at a hearing of that committee this past Tuesday.
Approximately how many nuclear warheads does Russia have aimed at the U.S. and the U.S. have aimed at Russia?
In a geopolitical environment where one of the U.S.'s NATO allies has shot down a Russian warplane, quickly followed by a U.S. announcement that it was outfitting its planes over Syria with air-to-air missiles, Gabbard's questions marked the first time that a member of Congress has publicly addressed one of the possible outcomes of further escalation. The Defense Secretary's response, though not specific, did make Representative Gabbard's point, albeit with a little coaxing.
Congresswoman, I will get you those precise numbers as best we know them. Let me just summarize it by the fact that we have I'm confident, a strong, safe, secure, and reliable deterrent. But it's also true that Russia, like the Soviet Union that precedes it, has a massive nuclear arsenal.
Right. And it would be accurate to say that both of our countries have the capacity to launch these nuclear weapons within minutes.
We do.
Representative Gabbard then asked about the military's estimation of the damage such an exchange would visit upon the U.S.
I've seen pictures, films, and images from Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I know you have as well. And I presume you would agree with me that nuclear war would be devastating to the American people. The amount of suffering that it would cause and the devastation to our families, our children, our communities, our planet, our future generations is difficult to imagine. So I'm wondering if there's been an assessment on how many lives would be lost and the damage that would be done if this nuclear war between our two countries were to occur.
Congresswoman, I've been doing this for a long time, including during the Cold War, and working on nuclear weapons since the beginning of my career. To answer your question, there have been estimates made right along when there was a Soviet Union, then a Russia, and it's a very simple story. It is, as you say, nuclear war would be a absolutely unprecedented and result in catastrophic destruction. That is why deterrence is so important. That's why prudence in the field of nuclear matters by leaders all over the world is so essential.
Gabbard, an Iraq war vet, then asked Secretary Carter some specific questions about U.S. operations in Syria.
So the fact that we now have our F-15s patrolling the Turkey-Syria border with that primary air-to-air combat operation, there's no air-to-air combat against ISIS. They don't have any air assets. So I can only presume that the purpose of these planes would be to target Russian planes. Is that accurate?
Congressman, let me answer your larger, the point you began with, which is we have a different view, a very different view from Russia about what would be constructive for them to do in Syria. We have that disagreement. We can't align ourselves with what they're doing. We're opposing and want them to change what they're doing in Syria. That's not the same as the United States and Russia clashing. I think that the chairman and his counterpart in Russia just talked yesterday about making sure that we didn't, by accident, have any incident involving U.S. and Russian forces. So we have a sharp disagreement there, but that's not the same as blundering into a armed situation with one another.
But that sharp disagreement, sorry, I only have a minute here, that sharp disagreement with two diametrically opposed objectives. One, the U.S. seeking to overthrow the Syrian government of Assad, Russia seeking to uphold the Syrian government of Assad, creates that potential, that strong potential and strong likelihood for that head-to-head combat or that head-to-head military conflict. And Russia's installation of their anti-aircraft missile defense system increases that possibility of whether it's intentional or even an accidental event where one side may shoot down the other side's plane. And that's really where the potential is for this devastating nuclear war, for something that could blow up into something much larger.
The defense secretary did not address that possibility directly.
I have to correct something, Congressman, that you said, which is that I would characterize Russia's perspective differently. And by the way, what they say and what they do are two different things. What they said they were going to do was fight ISIL and pursue a political transition and not support Assad endlessly, but instead try to pursue a political solution. What they've done militarily has had the effect of supporting Assad, no question about it. And they haven't gone after ISIL. They've gone after moderate. That's our source of disagreement. We're having that disagreement and trying to get them to come around. That is what Secretary Kerry's doing, to a more reasonable and constructive position. But at the same time, as the chairman's efforts indicate, we are, and the Russians agree with this, intent upon avoiding a accidental situation in the air over Syria.
In a later appearance on CNN, Representative Gabbard expressed the essential part of her concern with current U.S. policy.
I want to mention one thing that is deeply concerning to me that's happening right now at the Turkey-Syria border. We have U.S. F-15 planes patrolling that border between those two countries at the same time that Russia has put in place a very sophisticated anti-aircraft missile defense system. This is deeply concerning to me because this, again, puts the United States and Russia at a head-to-head conflict with the possibility, whether it's intentional or even an accident, that one side will shoot down the other side's plane, kicking off what is a much larger, potentially world war and a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. And the thing is with this, we've got to ask ourselves, what will the cost of this be? Devastation to the American people, to the world, and what for what? What's the benefit? Why are we trying to do this in Syria? Why are we trying to go to war with Russia over this disagreement of overthrowing the Syrian government of Assad? It's crazy.
Meanwhile, at the daily press conference at the U.S. State Department Wednesday, the claim made by Russia's defense ministry that Turkey is involved in smuggling oil for ISIS was at the center of the conversation, with spokesperson Mark Toner finding himself in the hot seat.
Russian Minister of Defense showed satellite images accusing Turkey that thousands of oil trucks have been heading towards Turkey, that Turkey buys, process, and transport this ISIS oil. What's your comment on that?
Sure. Aware of those reports. I haven't actually seen the photos. Look, we reject outright the premise that the Turkish government is in league with ISIL to smuggle oil across its borders. And we frankly see no evidence, none, to support such an accusation. Frankly, we believe Turkey is taking the necessary steps, and Secretary of State Kerry spoke about this earlier today in Brussels, to improve the security of its borders with Syria. Does more need to be done? Certainly. But let me finish. But in cooperation with international partners, these efforts will continue in the coming months and weeks. You know, talking more broadly about oil smuggling, it is a challenge what ISIL is doing. It certainly remains or is necessary, I think, to shut this down. It's a decades-old practice, frankly, that predates ISIL, of illicit trade in this region. And frankly, it's a challenge that's stymied ISIL's own ability to generate revenue. What we have seen, in fact, is that ISIL relinquishes ownership and sells its oil at the wellhead in Syria and Iraq, And that oil is sold to smugglers, middlemen, truckers. We talked a couple weeks ago about one of our airstrikes against one of these convoys of trucks. You know, and ISIL gains revenue by extorting tolls, oil transportation within its own territory. And frankly, what we talked about before as well is the fact that, you know, we believe that Assad himself was also one of the purchasers of ISIL's oil. Please finish and then I'll get to you.
So do you mean that this Russian satellite and reconnaissance images are inaccurate?
Are what? I'm sorry.
Inaccurate?
Again, I haven't seen them. I just don't know what to make of them. You know, I don't want to. I've heard secondhand that they don't show much. Again, we don't believe there's any truth to the fact that their claims that the Turkish government is somehow complicit in illegal oil trade with ISIL. It's just not true.
And can you confirm that, in general, ISIL oil can be found in Turkey market?
I can't confirm that, but it wouldn't surprise me, as I talked about, is, you know, there's this decades-old smuggling, frankly, older than decades, smuggling routes along these borders, working with Turkey, as our other international partners, to secure those borders. But that's a hard challenge in that part of, in that region. It's very mountainous. It's very difficult to get the kind of presence you need. But that's something we're working with Turkey and with others to address.
Was the U.S. Aware of ISIL's oil being smuggled into Turkey?
We've talked all the long time. I mean, we've been very much aware of ISIL's intent and, in fact, ability to cash in on the oil that it's been pumping out. As I just said, what we've seen. What we've seen is that ISIL very well or very often sells its oil, as I said, at the wellhead. So as it comes out of the ground, there's smugglers, there's middlemen, there's truckers who then take that through these established routes. Some of them, probably lead to parts of Turkey. I can't categorically rule that out, but it's not what was implied, which is that the Turkish government is somehow complicit in this arrangement. That's just untrue.
But one moment. The Russian Defense Ministry also, you know, it has published many, many aerial images of what it says are oil trucks going into Turkey. And it has published exact locations and routes of how ISIL's oil flows into Turkey and where it goes from there. Is it information that the U.S. is interested in?
Is it information the U.S. is interested in? We have our own ways of getting that information, of looking at that area, it is our assessment that that is not true. I don't want to...
Are you saying it's not true that oil is being smuggled into Turkey?
No. That, again, let's be very clear, the allegations that were made today, which is that the Turkish government is complicit in oil smuggling over from ISIL into Turkey. That's the allegations that were made out of Russia today, and that's what I'm rejecting. Whether there's some kind of illegal oil smuggling taking place around the border region, as I just said, that's been something that's been going on for decades. It's something we're taking steps to address, and frankly, we're hitting ISIL's oil production facilities or oil resources harder than ever in the past month or so. Dave?
You talk about a difficult border, but oil tankers travel by road.
Right.
It's not all that complicated to track oil tankers.
Right. Well, I don't want to. First of all, we did hit a convoy of these trucks a little while ago. The area, again, I don't want to get in for a tit for tat talking about these satellite photos.
The trucks are driven by civilians.
Sure. And we actually dropped leaflets in our efforts to avoid civilian casualties. We dropped leaflets to these truckers, letting them know that their trucks are going to be a target. But, again, I don't want to get into a tit-for-tat over the credibility of some of these photos, but our understanding is that this is very difficult terrain for convoys of trucks to pass easily.
After one reporter asked the question about the administration's position on any possible role of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in negotiations for a political settlement, the press brought the discussion back to the issue of the Turkish government's role in ISIS oil smuggling.
Can we just come back to this oil thing? Because
sure.
the Russians have been very specific about this. What you're rejecting is that the Turkish, you know, Erdogan and so on are involved in this. That's what you're rejecting, right?
I am, and that's been.
So that specifically.
Well, 2 points of clarity or clarification, rather. That has been a central argument that they've been making, for the past week or so, that the Turkish government is complicit in this smuggling. I can't deny that there's, or I can't say categorically that there's not smuggling taking place on the Turkish-Syrian border. As I said, that's long established and predates ISIL. Let me finish. But what we've seen through our own intelligence and sources is that a lot of that transaction takes place, as I said, at the wellhead or at the source, and it's then sold to the smugglers, truck drivers, whatever, who then carry out whatever that network of smuggling is.
The Russian.
The problem with this is that you say you categorically reject the allegations that the Russians have made, but I don't. Can you speak for all elements of the Turkish government? Are you able to say that there isn't anyone in the Turkish government who is not involved in the kind of thing that the Russians are accusing them of being involved in?
We're confident that the Turks are strong partners in addressing this threat on their border, and they're working in conjunction with you. I can't categorically, say that some corrupt official and
right.
some
you,
yeah, but
you
what,
can't
what
say
the
that
allegations
about the
are no, but
much
Matt,
less about the US
what the allegations have been is that
know.
The Turkish government has yeah. that the Erdogan president have been complicit in this, and that's not true.
Can you speak for them really? I mean, how are you so sure?
We work very closely with the Turks. Okay. We've been in dialogue with them, discussions with them. They're a NATO ally and a trusted partner.
But Mark, the thing is that
the oil smuggling that's going on, do you reject that too? The scale?
The scale of it?
Yes.
I don't have any.
These aerial images show huge convoys with what Russia says are oil trucks crossing the Turkish-Syrian border unhindered. And one of the images shows, and there are many, shows 240 trucks on the Turkish side of the border and over 40 similar trucks on the Syrian side of the border.
Again, I'm not
Are you saying
to...
that it doesn't raise any red flags here?
Well, look, first of all, I'm not going to speak to the credibility of your satellite imagery from this podium, certainly. Secondly, no, we've never said that oil smuggling from ISIL is not a problem. What I'm trying to say is that there's no Turkish government complicity in some operation to buy illegal oil from ISIL. It's just we just don't believe that to be true in any way, shape, or form. There is smuggling that takes place across that border. That's one of the reasons why we're working with Turkey to seal that border. But as to the scale of it, I don't have any estimates to give to you.
Well, one of the
Please,
things is
ahead.
That they say is that there's no inspection of these vehicles. I mean, one would think. You know, as my colleague David said, was that, these are large trucks and then you stop them. And the fact is that what the Russians are saying, nobody, I guess the complicity would be the fact that they don't stop and inspect these things. So that's what, what is the U.S. Been doing specifically on trying to stop the smuggling and from that oil getting into the international markets?
Well, again, it's something we're working with Turkey. I'm not going to outline the steps. Secretary Kerry spoke to it earlier today, but we are actively working on ways that we can seal that border, that we can end these routes as much as they exist, where smuggling may be taking place.
It's going to a refinery. Do you know which refinery it's going to?
I don't, from this podium, have that information.
About the 98 kilometers of border that Secretary Kerry was talking this morning?
That's one of the areas. I think what the Russians are purporting is a different area of the border.
It is not only Turkey. Maybe it's because of the Russia problem with Turkey is just been focusing on that. It's also there are proofs of ISIL smuggling with other areas, including Iraqi border inside Iraq and also Jordan and other places. So if don't you think this is ISIS is exploiting the financial situation of these regions, the, for example, the Kurdish region of Iraq, Iraqi government, and also Turkey, because I mean, if they are successful,
there's obviously, yes, it is partly due to the lack of stability in the region that leads to this kind of smuggling operation to take place. We've always identified one of the main efforts in our anti-ISIL coalition to be ending ISIL's illicit trade in the region, whether it's through oil or through other devices or other products or resources. That's key. You've got to cut off how they get their money, how they get their resources. So that's absolutely, I mean, we've, since day one of this coalition, we've said that that is a priority, and we've followed up on that priority. The point I'm trying to make here is those aren't ISIL trucks necessarily pouring over the, crossing the border, any border. These are smugglers. There are other truckers who are buying this from ISIL and then taking it elsewhere. The quality of the oil is not very good, frankly. That's another component to this. I mean, there's people in this department, frankly, who are far more knowledgeable about these routes, the quality of the oil, all this stuff, than I am, certainly. But it is our assessment that, it is not ISIL per se that who are taking this oil across borders or trying to smuggle it into others. They're quite content to sell it within their territories, frankly, that they occupy. Sorry.
But one of your arguments for this not being possibly just for this not being true is that the oil quality isn't good enough for the Turks. Yeah.
I mean, the oil quality is poor. Yes.
So they wouldn't accept poor quality oil.
Well, whatever. It just wouldn't be. It's just not very. It's not very desirable. But I'm not saying that that's an excuse for, or that's the reason for not participating in this. Wow. I mean, look, Turkey continues to be a strong partner in the anti-ISIL coalition. Do we all need to do more? Does Turkey need to do more to stop this kind of activity? Certainly. To seal up their borders, secure their borders? Certainly. And that's what we're working with them on.
Are you saying that if ISIS oil is loaded on trucks that belong to some local smugglers, that's no longer ISIL oil?
Not at all, but I'm saying it's not ISIL truckers who are taking this across the borders, and that's what the insinuation, at least, that was made today in Russia.
That's still part of their business, isn't it? That's part of their revenue.
I think I made that really clear. I said that they sell it from the wellhead to these networks of smugglers and oil smugglers and drivers and others who then take this across the border or take it to other parts of Syria. By the way, they also sell it to Assad and Assad's regime, and Russia's the number one supporter of Assad. So
on November 17th, Secretary
Turkey is a strong partner, a U.S. partner. So yep. Do you believe that Turkey is unable to close the border? Is it like big challenge for?
It is a challenge. My understanding, and I'm not an expert on the territory, but my understanding is that it's a difficult border to control.
Assad is buying ISIL oil as well, and Russia is supporting it. Are you in touch with the Russian officials
Russia is well aware of our concerns about A, their ongoing support for Assad. B, Assad's complicity in this oil smuggling, and then C, the fact that we need to resolve the issue of the civil war that is taking place in order to turn our attention A, to stop the atrocities that the Assad regime is committing on a daily basis, and then B, to confront the broader enemy, which is ISIL.
This Friday marks the 46th anniversary of the assassination by the FBI and Chicago police of the head of the Windy City's chapter of the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton, on December 4th, 1969. Black Agenda reports Bruce Dixon worked with the man his comrades referred to as simply Chairman Fred, and he offered the following in his memory.
I remember Fred Hampton. For the last year of his life, which was the whole time I knew him, he was deputy chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. Fred was a big man, whose inexhaustible energy, keen insight, and passionate commitment to the struggle made him seem even larger still. We called him Chairman Fred. Chairman Fred was murdered by the FBI and the Chicago Police Department in the pre-dawn hours of December 4th, 1969. He was just 21 years old. Fred's family and comrades mourned him for a little while and have celebrated his life of struggle, service, intensity, and sacrifice ever since. For such a short life, there is much to celebrate. A gifted communicator and a natural leader, Fred was organizing other high school students at the age of 15. Though a brilliant student, he passed up the chance to attend some elite college, the straight road to some lucrative and prestigious career. Inspired by examples from the civil rights movement to anti-colonial struggles in Vietnam and Africa, Fred chose instead to live and work on the west side of Chicago and to devote all his talents and energies to ending the oppression of woman and man by man, helping to organize and to lead the Black Panther Party in Chicago. Chairman Fred led by example. He had high standards, and he challenged all those in his orbit to get up as early, to read as much, and to work as hard and study as productively as he did. I never saw anybody meet that challenge for long, but he made us all want to keep trying. Fred sought out principled critiques of his own practices and taught us the vital role of constructing, receiving, and acting on such criticism in building a sound organization. Fred assumed a leading role in organizing the party's Breakfast for Children program, in which we solicited donations of food and facilities and provided or recruited the labor to serve free hot breakfasts to children on the way to school in some of the city's poorest neighborhoods, where local authorities assured us that no hunger problem existed. Not long afterward, the city of Chicago began using federal funds to provide hot breakfast to children in lower-income neighborhoods across the city. Fred worked with the Medical Committee for Human Rights to open the Black Panther Party's free medical clinic on the west side of Chicago, where authorities again declared that there was no shortage of such services. And again, not long afterward, the Chicago Board of Health was persuaded of the need to open a network of clinics providing free and low-cost services to the city's poorer areas, some of which remained open decades after Fred's death. Fred reached out to work with the Young Lords organization in Chicago's Puerto Rican community and to a group of white working-class youth who called themselves the Young Patriots. He made time to speak with student groups in high schools and colleges all over Chicago and the surrounding area. He organized community surveys to get snapshots of the actual and perceived needs of some neighborhoods. 1969 was well before the epidemics of powdered and crack cocaine put large and permanently corrupting sums of money into the hands of gang leaders. In his time, Fred was instrumental in crafting a principled approach not just to individual gang members, but to the rank and file as well as the leaderships of Chicago's two major street gangs to put aside their differences and to work for the good of the entire community. Fred's efforts in this regard met with some initial success and earned him some extra special attention from the FBI. There was much more, really an awful, awful lot going on for a young man of only 20 or 21, all the more amazing as most members of the organization he led were a year or two or three younger than Fred. Despite arrests and threats of imprisonment or death hanging over him, Fred persevered and challenged us to do the same. He was impatient with injustice, as the finest young people of every age will always be. Fred was animated, almost consumed, by a love for our people and for all humanity, and determined to do whatever it took to end the exploitation of woman and man by man. Times do change, and the mechanisms of oppression evolve into new forms. Political organizations and strategic visions crafted for the needs of one era do not make the grade in another. If Fred was alive today, he'd be a grandfather in his 60s. It's impossible to know exactly how he'd be doing it, but there is no doubt that Fred would still be teaching and learning and inspiring, still tirelessly organizing and struggling in the great cause of human liberation. Chairman Fred called us to a lifetime of service to humanity. If we weren't doing something revolutionary, Fred told us many times, we shouldn't even bother to remember him. So, 40 years on and counting, we continue to work hard to be worthy of his memory. For Black Agenda Report, I'm Bruce Dixon.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.